Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Cairo for an update on the elections in Egypt with Yasmin El-Rashidi, a former Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. We will discuss the strong showing by the Muslim Brotherhood and the fundamentalist Salafists in the first round of the parliamentary elections and look ahead to the next critical and contentious steps, which are the drafting of a new constitution and the presidential elections. Then we are joined in the studio by Julie Levine, who teaches at the USC School of Social Work and has been involved in the Occupy LA movement since its beginning. She will discuss the alleged mistreatment and police brutality the occupiers have endured since the police raid and the wider issues of the future direction of the Occupy movement and the 99%'s relationship to the corporate state. Then finally, Chris Fair joins us to examine what really happened in the recent clash between NATO forces and the Pakistanis, in which 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed. We will discuss why President Obama has not apologized to the Pakistanis because they opened fire first on the NATO and Afghan troops across the border, and when NATO gave the Pakistani military headquarters the coordinates to return fire, there was no objection. We will assess whether the U.S. will again turn a blind eye in order to open up supply routes into Afghanistan or take a firmer stand. I'm joined by Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She joins us from Cairo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian.
And the elections are underway in Egypt, and they go on through January. It seems to operate on a regional basis. So far, there's been a certain amount of alarm expressed in the West and in the media here in the United States about how well the Muslim Brotherhood have done, but in particular how well the Salafists have done. So two questions. Let's begin with the Salafists. What is your sense of how much they pose a threat to the secular nature of Egyptian society?
I think sort of in the short term, I don't think they pose a threat. I think that both the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists, you know, they have been portrayed as the big bad wolf, and they know it. And even though there are some sort of preachers and politicians among them who are speaking a very radical speak about what they want to see change in the country, for the most part, they seem to have an understanding that they have to first prove themselves to win the support of the people and to sort of dispel this idea that they are going to turn Egypt into Iran. So I think in the short term, we'll actually see them trying to win the support of people.
But isn't there a significant difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists?
There is. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood are known to be more moderate. And the Salafists are much more, they're known to be, especially I think in their discourse, you know, aside from what they believe in their discourse in the past few months, the Salafists have been much more radical. They've thrown out, you know, all sorts of statements, we're going to ban alcohol, to bathing suits won't be allowed, to we need to cover all the pharaonic statues. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood are much savvier. They've been, you know, preparing for this moment for 80 years. They've been, you know, they were oppressed under the former regime. And so they're being much, much more careful. But I think ultimately, sort of bottom line and long term, they both essentially want the same thing, which is a state governed by the principles of the Islamic Sharia, which they feel will be sort of the answer to both the social and economic woes of the country. And I think in part their vision is that, you know, Egypt is in the state that it's in because it had veered so far from the principles of Islam.
Well, of course, Islam doesn't tell you how to pick up the garbage, does it, in terms of the day-to-day?
No, it doesn't. I mean, one thing I think we need to remember, you know, another difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists is the Muslim Brotherhood, although they were oppressed under the former regime and although they were not recognized as a political entity and they were not allowed to form a party, they were, you know, they were, they're very successful in business. They are among the leaders and the administrators in some of the most successful and well-managed syndicates and unions in the country. And so they have, they actually have a lot of, you know, hands-on practical experience. So I think, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood are bringing that to the table, and I think they will try and use those skills to create services for the people, to try and bring more order into the system, and to appease this fear of them. The Salafists, I think, will be forced in some way to compete. I mean, if they want to, you know, begin to win more support amongst the people, I think they'll have to do the same. And if one looks at how they've been campaigning the past few months, and how, as you said, you know, everyone is surprised at the percentage votes they seem to have so far. I think it's a direct result of the fact that they were using a very similar line to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is appealing to the poor with the offering of social services, speaking about the economy, speaking about the price of food. So I think, you know, we're seeing both Islamist factions walk a similar line to try to win support.
I imagine, though, Yasmin, that the Coptic Christian population in Egypt is quite concerned about the Nur, the Salafists doing so well. They are quite xenophobic towards Christians, aren't they? And the Copts are up to 15% of the population.
The Christian population and the moderate or secular Muslim population, which is like more of an upper-class population, are extremely concerned. I mean, the past few days, everywhere you go, people are talking about the Islamists and what this means and if we should leave the country or not leave the country. You know, one thing to point out is that the only Copts who made it into parliament are members of the Muslim Brotherhood. So there are Copts in parliament on sort of the ticket of the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, had made a huge effort, in particular in the past month, to show that they are open to Copts, they are open to women, they are moderate. But of course, it's not doing, you know, it's not helping to appease people. And right now, you know, there's been a lot of anger towards the de facto ruling military council over the past few months over how they've managed the affairs of the country in this transitional period. Right now, most of the Copts, and I would say a big chunk of the liberals, even the liberal Muslims, now feel that the hand of the military council in the country's affairs would be a good thing moving forward, because it's better than giving the Islamists sort of full control over a parliament. And I think that we'll begin to see, you know, liberals and Copts pushing for that as a way to try to secure their interests and try to secure a somewhat secular state.
So the turnout of about 60%, does that indicate, who were the 40% that didn't show up? Because my understanding is that the Liberals have felt very disappointed. They felt on both occasions with the original revolution in Tahrir Square and the more recent second revolution, if you will, that they were the ones that did the heavy lifting, and the Brotherhood and the Salafists sat on the sidelines, and now they're reaping all the rewards. So give us a sense of the 40% who didn't show up.
I mean, I would say the 40% who didn't show up are probably from the informal settlements, where I think the Muslim Brotherhood they have a large network, sort of on a grassroots network, but it's hard in the informal settlements to really get people to come out. And I think in part it's because those areas aren't sort of, you know, they're not formally part of any district. There aren't public schools there. And all the voting stations happen in you know, they turn public schools into voting stations. And in the informal areas, you don't have that. And I think that a sizable chunk, I mean, you know, the informal settlement, about 40% of the Egyptian population live in informal settlements. So I would say that you're seeing, you know, I think it's mainly from there. But to go back to, you know, again, where the votes are coming from, I think it's, and, you know, and the question of, you know, or the people, why the people who did the work at the revolution are now sort of being sidelined, I want to point out that the Muslim Brotherhood were actually critical to the revolution. On January 25th, there was a sizable turnout, but it was definitely not enough to make a revolution. And it was only on January 28th when the Muslim Brotherhood did come out that we formed the critical mass. And it was them who actually protected the square. They formed, you know, human shields. They formed barricades. They were the ones who were searching people. And so I think actually in many ways they did a huge amount of work for the revolution. And I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, they're now reaping the benefits. I think they were a part of it too.
But Yasmin,
I support an extremist state, but...
But just to clarify, though, something that I'm sure our audience is not aware of, and I hadn't heard about the idea that there are these informal areas that you referred to in the Egyptian electorate. So are they sort of poor areas with kind of migrant-type workers or without full government infrastructure? Give me a sense of what you mean by the informal areas.
I suppose the equivalent, in another country they would call them slum areas. Although they're not really slum areas. People have built brick houses, but they're not sort of part of, you know, the urban planning of the city. They're literally probably migrants from rural areas have come in closer to the city, have begun, you know, they started to build these red, you know, brick, a lot of unfinished housing. They're not, you know, they don't have the services that anyone in the city has. A lot of them don't have running water. They don't have, you know, a proper sewage system. The government isn't really servicing those areas.
You mentioned earlier, Yasmin, the idea that the Islamists, both the Muslim Brotherhood, who gained the most votes, 36.6%, and the Nur, which are the Islamists, the more fundamentalist group, Salafists, they captured 24.4%. That they're not intent upon creating an Iranian-style state, theocracy. But my understanding is that the Salafists, the Nur party, have been getting a lot of money from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf.
They do have support from the Gulf. They don't have sort of formal, or not to our knowledge, they don't have formal support in terms of state support, but they are getting money, you know, through some wealthy individuals, through mosques or foundations, you know, that are sort of channeling money to them here. So they are definitely, there is support in that way. I don't think it's on a state level, but they are, you know, well endowed, and part of that is coming from abroad, definitely.
So their model would be a Saudi-type model, would that be? Except there wouldn't be a royal family involved. What kind of political model are they following? Not the Iranians, surely.
I think that it would be, aside from actually sort of who's the ruler and who's, you know, the number two, on a you know, kind of just ideologically and in terms of, you know, the political ideology, I'd say it's much closer to Saudi Arabia. I think that they do see, you know, they want religion to govern the state in that way. They definitely, I would say, see it, that type of segregation between men and women. In terms of dress codes, I think that they definitely see things, you know, in a similar light. So I would say their vision is closer to the Saudi one. I don't think all of them. I think there are some Salafis who are sort of, you know, more Puritan than radical, and in that sense they're more moderate. But I would say that at the core, when you talk of the Salafis and what they want, it's definitely closer to a Saudi model.
Well, just in closing, Yasmin El-Rashidi, this first round of votes, or the subsequent rounds of votes, go on through January. I take it it's done on a regional basis. And then my understanding is that, assuming that the Supreme Council of the military rulers stick to their word, that the presidential elections will be in June, I believe. At least that was the latest offer. What's your sense of when you're saying that now the Liberals may actually need the military as a buffer against the Islamists? Would that mean that the president would likely to be from the liberal and secular camp? And what is it? What will be the division of powers between the presidential power and the parliament?
I mean, I think my sense of what happens next is I think there will be a huge battle sort of within and around Parliament about the drafting of the Constitution. I think the Islamists in Parliament will push to have full authority over, you know, who drafts the Constitution and how. I think the Liberals will do everything they can to push back against that and to involve the ruling military council, because the military council has, you know, been very clear and stated that Egypt should remain a democratic, civil, and modern state. And I think that, you know, the plan was that this constitution would be drafted and then we would have presidential elections, which theoretically will take place in June. My sense is that there will be so much argument and difference over the constitution that drafting will not take place in time for elections in June. When the elections happen, it's another story. And my sense is that, you know, the fact that we are seeing what appears to be a largely Islamist parliament, you know, coming into office, I don't necessarily think that means that we will also see an Islamist president. When you speak to people on the street, you feel that they want actually a statesman as a president who does, you know, who is rooted to the culture, who doesn't drink and, you know, is a Muslim, but someone, you know, like more along the lines of Amr Musa, for example. Even though I've heard, you know, a lot of people in the past few days have told me the only problem with Amr Musa is that he drinks wine. So I think that they're looking for more of a statesman and a diplomat than anything else. That's my sense. I mean, I think things could change, but right now that seems to be the discourse on the street.
But the real battle, as you just pointed out, Yasmin, it will be for the Constitution and how it's drafted.
I think so. I think that is what will divide the country once again in the coming months.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure speaking to you.
Likewise. Again, I've been speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She joined us from Cairo. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined in the studio by one of the organizers of the Occupy LA movement to talk about where the movement's heading.
Close to the water, the current's been sweeping us in. I'm just waiting on you to bring yourself to justice. Forget about the past, it's already lost. I'm just waiting on you to know we've been discovered.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Julie Levine, who teaches at the USC School of Social Work. And she has been involved with the Occupy LA movement since its beginning. She serves on the Facilitation, Action, and Civil Engagement Committees for Occupy LA and is working with Occupy LA activists to create a people's tribunal to share the stories of those arrested at Occupy LA in order to build a public awareness of the raid and the alleged mistreatment and brutality by police and sheriffs, as well as the larger policy issues of the 99%'s relationship to the corporate state. Thank you for joining us, Julie Levine.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on the show.
So tell me about this alleged mistreatment and brutality by the police and sheriffs.
Right. I have to say I'm really shocked and very upset. I myself personally am traumatized, and I wasn't even arrested. Basically, what we saw was a staged media blackout at 2 a.m. when the corporate media that had been selected to cover the raid went off the air. The true violence began. Those assembled in the circle, and I know because I was in the circle the night before all night and became quite ill, had all been trained in nonviolent civil disobedience. They were chanting, "We are peaceful, we are peaceful." Meanwhile, the LAPD and the sheriff, many of them in LAPD uniforms, descended from the steps, as you know, on the occupiers that were exercising their First Amendment rights. They were arrested. Some of them were beaten. Some of them had their face and knees shoved into the concrete ground. They were tied with these plastic handcuffs very, very tightly around their wrists, so tightly that one woman blacked out. All of them that have since been released and have come to our General Assembly meetings, which are held nightly at 7:30, are shaken, are traumatized. They have welts. They have bruises. They were brutalized and they were tortured. At least one busload of women, of at least 40 women, were detained on the bus, which was operated by the county sheriff's office, for 8 hours, during which time they were not allowed to drink, eat, but worse, they were not allowed to urinate. They were told they could urinate on the seat. Another busload of men who were detained had the same treatment and also were forced to pee in their seat. Meanwhile, the sheriffs went to Starbucks and took a coffee break. They were placed in three different jails, Metro Van Nuys and I believe Twin Towers. 300 people as of last night were arrested, and the arrests continue. There were at least two arrests yesterday, one of a man who was simply with a sign on the steps of City Hall. Evidently, they imposed some kind of a 12 o'clock curfew in what the mayor had declared was a First Amendment steps, where we could exercise our First Amendment rights, and he was arrested last night for holding a sign on those very steps. Yesterday during the day, we had another arrest of someone who was riding his bicycle on the street. He was told to go on the sidewalk, knowing that you are not supposed to ride your bicycle on the sidewalk. He did not. He was also arrested, and my understanding is that he was beaten. We are hearing more and more stories of those that are detained that are coming out of jail. Some of them have been beaten. Others have been kept in solitary confinement. The worst treatment has been at the hands of the county sheriff's office. And meanwhile, on Channel 4 this morning, I hear Colin Nolan reporting he has Chief Beck, LAPD Chief Beck, on the air saying that this is an example, a national example of peaceful handling of dispersing and, quote, illegal assembly. And he has as well Mitchell Englander, city council member, on the air talking about the huge cost of the occupation. What about the cost of those 1,400 to 1,700 officers in riot gear that descended on peaceful, and I mean peaceful, protesters exercising their First Amendment rights? What about those who were shot with beanbags, who have huge welts and are in splints, etc.? They are coming in one by one, 20 by 20, and their stories are shocking and need to come out. And I thank you. I thank you for giving us this opportunity.
So, Julie Levine, how do you prove these allegations? I mean, one, that the sheriffs were wearing LAPD uniforms, and two, this treatment. If you're going to organize, or you are organizing, this people's forum as a tribunal to share these stories, is that the vehicle by which this information will come out? And I imagine you are hoping to get some press coverage of this, right?
Well, I have to say the National Tribunal is an idea that came to us from Steve Rohde of the ACLU. It hasn't yet been consensed upon by the General Assembly. We're working, we're planning it now, and we're going to present it as a proposal. We're a participatory democracy movement, so nothing moves forward without that consensus. That having been said, those who have been detained are telling their stories. Corporate media came by last night to our General Assembly and listened to some stories. Let's see if they cover them. We hope that they will. We are getting signed statements, written statements from all of those who are detained. We will make sure that this story is told, and the National Lawyers Guild and other attorneys are doing an excellent job of representing us. We will make sure this story comes out, but meanwhile, we just want those of you listening to the show today to spread the word, please, to let people know that what is being told is a lie. This is not what occurred. This is not what took place. This was not peaceful. This is a police state. Every night, we're in what we call Occupation 2.0 right now, okay? We no longer have, tents, but those of us have multiplied. We have moved our General Assemblies from like 50 to 80 people sometimes a night. Now we have 200, 400 people a night. The word is getting out on the streets, and I believe the 99% is starting to realize that, you know, we are quickly moving into a police state. This National Defense Authorization Act, co-sponsored by Senator Levin and Senator McCain, if this is passed, we hope that the president will veto it. If so, it'll go back to the House of Representatives. But this act will put 20,000 military on the streets specifically to squash peaceful protesters and allow indefinite detention. We really need to, all of us need to stand up now. All of us have to speak out against this, because this is a lie. We are living, when you come to City Hall, because we are still allowed to be there on the West Steps and exercise our rights, but you'll notice that as you come for our 7:30 meeting, where you can find out and be plugged into all the actions that we're involved in, you'll notice that there are police everywhere and there are helicopters lingering overhead. There's a feeling of intimidation in the air. I have never experienced anything like this in my entire life, and I just urge people in Los Angeles of conscience to join us and see what is going on and the new movement that we are at the dawn of creating.
Now, I'm sure our audience have seen the pepper spraying incident at UC Davis and the general kind of militarization of the police that has taken place since 2011, since 9/11, and Homeland Security, of course, is a huge government agency without a specific mission. They don't really know what they're doing, but they are spending a ton of money, which they give federal money to police forces to buy equipment. And I think that is probably a part of this militarization that you're talking about. But in terms of the movement itself, since you're one of the people that have been there from the beginning, and I've been down there and I've talked to a bunch of people who've been down there, and you mentioned your idea or what you're working on as a tribunal has to go before the General Assembly. Give us a sense, though, of how the occupation has operated, because some of the people involved that I've interviewed said that it was very difficult to maintain the idealism and integrity of the camp, because all the street people, the junkies and the hustlers were coming in and stealing your food and stuff like that. Where does that stand?
Yes. I'm really glad you asked that question, Ian, because I have very good news in that regard. Since the raid occurred, and actually we're very thankful to Mayor Villaraigosa, because by, you know, conducting the raid in the way that he did and really lying in the way that he did, he has mobilized our movement. The gang members, the Crips and the Bloods and whatnot that were there, the number of those that were involved in the encampment that were not contributing in a positive manner, they've left. They've left. Now that there's no longer food available, the tents are not available, they have left our movement. Last night, we consensed on three proposals. Two of them had to do with responding to this National Defense Authorization Act. We actually have a rally that's starting at City Hall today at 12 noon. We will have a port action in solidarity with cities all over the state on December 12th to close down the ports in solidarity with the longshoremen and the truckers. We are planning for a general strike on May 1st. We have many, 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 many actions. We're in action mode now. We also consensed on a protest of Sheriff Baca because of the way the county has been involved in all of this. So we are really in a very good position right now. Those who remain are those who are committed to action. And this entire experience and the police response has radicalized us, has made us fully aware that the system at its very core is corrupted and that the politicians in no way are going to be able to take on that system. And their intention does not seem to be to do that. So we do have some larger demands that we're moving forward. First, we would like to demand the immediate release of all the occupiers, not only in L.A., but nationally. We would like to see bail eliminated, $5,000 and $10,000 bail for loitering or failure to disperse. It's unconscionable and unheard of, and we want the charges dropped. Furthermore, we want the recall of all the public officials who've been part in squashing the Occupy movement locally and nationally. We want people to know this is not, the fact that, now there are middle class, because we've been reading the reports in the media. It's not about the fact that now there's middle class people that are being arrested and so suddenly we're outraged. This is about the fact that nobody deserves this kind of treatment. This is about human rights for everyone. This really helps set clear the fact that why is it that peaceful protesters are now the subject of this kind of recrimination when Wall Street is free and clear? Do I have time? I would like to read a statement by somebody who was detained who has allowed me to share this statement on the air.
Is this the letter that this person wrote to the LA Times?
That's correct.
Has the LA Times published it?
No, not to my knowledge.
Well, go ahead.
Thank you. This is by Patrick Meegan. He's an Occupy LA detainee, and he said that this statement could be shared. I'm speaking as a person who was arrested Wednesday morning at City Hall for the crime of peacefully, respectfully protesting the wholesale fraud perpetuated by our nation's financial sector. I just want to say, I'm not mad that an LAPD officer slammed me face first into the pavement. I'm not mad that my personal property was forcibly stolen, destroyed, and disposed of by the LAPD. I'm not mad that my arms were painfully zip-cuffed behind my back for 7 consecutive hours. I'm not mad that the LAPD zip-cuffs cut off circulation at my wrists, causing nerve damage to my right hand. I'm not mad that the LAPD spent the entire day refusing to accept all bail postings for nonviolent Occupy LA protesters like myself, while at the same time dutifully bonding and releasing countless violent arrestees back into LA streets. I'm not mad that the LAPD denied me access to a lawyer for the entire duration of my jail stay. What I am mad about is that none of the above has done to even one of the Wall Street criminals who committed the most egregious act of larceny in American history, trashing the lives and futures of millions of Angelenos and hundreds of millions of American citizens.
Now, Julie, I spoke recently with George Lakoff, who's in many ways provided some, I think, interesting ideas for progressives in terms of how they frame arguments and taking the position that the conservatives in this country are much better at framing arguments. But he did concede that the 99% versus the 1% is a very powerful and well-framed message. But he also said that he believes that this message, this movement, is much, much bigger than those in the tents, that it has moved into the consciousness of the country and into the very middle class that you were just talking about. So how do you keep that movement building, not alienate the middle class? Because if they're being told that you guys are wasting taxpayers' money, that's not helpful for building the movement. So explain to me the future strategy here.
Right. I appreciate that. Well, I believe that the 99% is definitely getting the message. I think it's very clear in a way that it was not clear before this occupation to most people, whether they call themselves Republicans, Democrats, liberals, whatever, that corporations are in fact in control of this government, of this system, and of the 1% media. We're so thankful that we have KPFK here in Los Angeles. They understand that their wages are going down, that they are losing their benefits. They understand that these mortgage foreclosures, many of them illegal, are by 1% banks who do not have their best interests. And they understand that right now, because corporations have more money than our government, and because they can give as much as they want to campaigns and to elected officials, that we do not have elected officials in power that can make a difference. This system is corrupt to the bone. And I think people are starting to understand and wake up to that fact. And so we really need them to join us in not only, you know, in speaking out with their elected officials, but also in just joining the movement in all of these areas around public funding of education and healthcare, ending corporate wars that, you know, trillions of dollars are going into these wars that could be going into supporting the people. And also right now, it's extremely important that people understand that we're moving full on into a police state. We cannot allow this National Defense Authorization Act to pass. So that's one of the main things that we're working on as an Occupy movement here in LA and nationally. And to understand that really the fate of all the world's people are the same right now, because just as yesterday we marched with the bus riders movement and other groups around climate change, to understand that these corporations, these 1% corporations, are really destroying the environment and our world, and that all of us really need to unite to take this on. And I think people are starting to get that message.
So just in the last minute, Julie, how will this new energy and activism that I think, in spite of your concerns about the corporate media, nevertheless, I think the polls indicate that the country has enormous support, much, much more support for the 99% Occupy movement than for the Tea Party, for example. How do you translate this this goodwill and this messaging that is clearly getting through to the American people? How does it translate into electoral politics? Because we have an election year coming up.
Right. Well, you know, so far as a movement, we have chosen not to engage in electoral politics, partly because we're not a reform movement. We're a peaceful movement, but we're a peaceful movement that understands that this system is really corrupted. We have to take the money out of politics. So we're concerned with the issues of taking money out of politics, public financing of campaigns, responsible banking ordinance. We want to see a national referendum around ending corporate personhood. Really, we need to understand that unless we have participatory democracy of the type that we are modeling in the Occupy movement, we will continue to be held hostage by that 1% corporate force that's really destroying all of our lives.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in the studio, Julie Levine.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Julie Levine, who teaches at the USC School of Social Work and has been involved with the Occupy LA movement since its beginning. She serves on the Facilitation, Action, and Civil Engagement Committees for Occupy LA and is working with Occupy LA activists to create a people's tribunal to share the stories of those arrested at Occupy LA in order to build a public awareness of the raid and the alleged mistreatment and brutality by police and sheriffs, as well as the larger policy issues of the 99%'s relationship to the corporate state. We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back talking about what really happened in that clash on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan recently that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within the Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School for Foreign Service. Previously, she served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistant Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate in the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Fair.
Hey, thank you for having me back.
And since we last spoke, there's been some major developments. Of course, the most serious, I guess, was the recent clash on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan that resulted in the death of 24 Pakistani soldiers. My understanding from talking to people in Washington who know what's going on is that, in fact, the reason that President Obama has not apologized, as the Pakistanis have demanded, he has said that they regret, and NATO said they regret the loss of life, but he has not apologized because it was the Pakistanis' post that opened fire first on the NATO and Afghan soldiers. Is that your understanding?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, of course, that's what's being said, but I do want to make it very clear that we're probably not really going to know what has happened, right? This isn't the first time that this has happened. The very first episode that came to public life was in June of 2008 when U.S. soldiers operating under NATO fired upon several frontier corpsmen on Pakistani territory, killed lots of folks. And what typically happens in these things is that it's very embarrassing for the Pakistan government. It's very difficult for the U.S. government and NATO, because we're so dependent upon Pakistan for resupply, that what we typically do, or what we have done in the past, is come up with some story which is mutually inconvenient. Sometimes it looks like, yes, we mistook you for Taliban. There's some issue of an apology. Usually there is some mutually both exculpatory as well as embarrassing story that allows both sides to get on with things. So I'm not confident that we're ever going to know what happened, because to put that forward, I think, would be very embarrassing for the Pakistanis. And if these early reports are untrue, obviously very embarrassing for NATO. That being said, this is the most litigious war that I think this country's ever fought. And the rules of engagement are so tight that it really takes an extraordinary leap of insanity to think that somehow NATO, using standoff weapons, fired at these Pakistani positions without any provocation. The other interesting thing to note is that prior to firing on the positions from which NATO forces were taking fire, NATO actually contacted, per protocol, Pakistani military headquarters, army headquarters, and gave those coordinates and said, we're getting fire, we're going to be putting ordnance on those positions. Do you have troops there? And Pakistani said no. So, you know, in essence, not only did the Pakistani side fire first, we also had clearance. NATO actually had clearance to fire on those positions from the Pakistani authority. So you can imagine Pakistan doesn't really want to get to the bottom of this. They just want to make political and as well as military authorities there simply want to make a lot of hay out of this.
Well, they are making a lot of hay in the Pakistani press. And just recently, a Pew survey said that only 12% of Pakistanis expressed a favorable view of the United States. Now, that's before this incident. How low can it go?
Oh, I mean, I imagine that's probably even an overestimate. You know, Pakistan, you know, I've been going to Pakistan now since 1991, which now I think about it, that's 20 years or something. You know, Pakistanis have never been terribly enthusiastic about Americans for as long as I've been going there. Remember, I went there right after the first Gulf War. But, you know, the problem with this relationship is that one of the worst partners in this is Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI. They are that organization is the architect of Pakistan's jihad under the nuclear umbrella. The organization controls, to a very considerable degree, Pakistani media. And it's able to, through the news anchors as well as the various print journal, so-called journalists that it pays, it's able to manipulate the media pretty effectively. And so what you saw in the aftermath of this attack was not waiting to understand what exactly happened, possibly exploring the possibility that Pakistan precipitated this in one way or another, or that, you know, there was some rational explanation for this. The Director General of the Inner Services Public Relations Organization, which is a spokesperson of the armed forces in Pakistan came out and said this was a deliberate, unprovoked American aggression on Pakistani forces. So what you see is there is no intention to on the Pakistani side to understand what happened. They're simply using this as yet another opportunity to make working with the United States, to make it difficult for the U.S. to work with Pakistan and to keep ratcheting up the price of Pakistan's so-called facilitation of the war on terror.
So, Chris Fair, would the recent recall and firing of the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, who appeared to have been caught in something of a sting, be another example of the ISI's influence over policy and how they use fair means or foul? I mean, I remember years ago speaking with this fellow, Mansour Ijaz, on a number of occasions, until I got the sense that he was ISI, or at least some kind of an asset, and stopped talking to him. But it looks like he set the ambassador up. Is that your understanding?
Well, boy, the memo gate, as it's known in South Asia, is really complicated. You know, for those folks who know Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, the man is often the smartest person in the room. The insight that after bin Laden was the time to bring the army and the ISI to its knees was really spot on. I mean, you'll never have an opportunity when the army was so disgraced and just in low regard among Pakistanis who woke up on the morning of May 2nd just whipsawed. I was actually there that week. I arrived 2 days after bin Laden was killed, you know, completely apropos of another commitment. And you could just see how dazed Pakistanis were and just how just disgusted they were at their army's incompetence. So the whole stratagem, which was to basically bring the United States in under the premise of a potential coup to further weaken the army in the ISI and to strengthen civilian leadership there with the premise that somehow those civilians would be more capable and competent in their commitment to fighting terrorism, is in of itself, A, not a bad idea, and it sure is not treason. But what you saw was that GHQ had the day. GHQ had him withdrawn. He's now been put on what Pakistan calls the export control list. He may be tried for treason. And it's preposterous. Pakistan's a parliamentary democracy. How is it that asking the primary benefactor, Pakistan's military, to help undo the benefit that is bestowed upon that organization to help strengthen civilians, how in the world is that treasonous? So I see the withdrawal of Haqqani and the things that he is now fighting to be very much a sign of GHQ's prowess. And then, of course, the woman that will replace him is an incredibly brave woman. The woman's got cojones. But that being said, just because she's a civil society darling, just because she is incredibly brave and has taken on the bigots who would like to have this horrific blasphemy law, doesn't mean that she's not very much favored by the army. In fact, some of her recent publications with a very pro-Pakistan military individual at USIP, sort of demonstrate that she is not distasteful or unpalatable to GHQ. Quite the contrary, she's very much a consensus candidate. She's going to appeal to Americans, but she's also going to be keeping Pakistan military's interests front and center as well.
Clearly, the Pakistan military, who receive over a quarter of its budget from the United States, they've always been in contest with the civilian authorities. But my understanding is that Imran Khan, the cricket hero, his party is gaining in popularity, and they're even more anti-American than the ISI is. It would seem so.
Well, okay, so Imran Khan is, of course, a puzzling fellow. I mean, he had quite a reputation for being a rakish Lothario and had quite a good time of doing things that would, qualify you for that reputation. Now he has turned the corner and he is embracing his life as a pious Muslim, or so he's saying, although there are a lot of people that are very dubious about his claims to his newfound piety. Many of the people in his party are allegedly activists from the Jamaat Islami. he has really come out of nowhere. And one has to be very suspicious when a politician in Pakistan comes out of nowhere, because that usually means that they're being propelled by the army and the ISI. And this is what, for example, happened with Nawaz Sharif. He was very much a product of GHQ and the ISI. He has a lot of things that appeal to the ISI. First of all, he's not President Zardari or the PPP. They have, obviously the GHQ can't stand that man. They also do not like the Pakistan Muslim League. Remember, after all, it was Nawaz Sharif that tried to dismiss Musharraf, and of course that played out dangerously in a coup that saw him being removed from power. So the first advantage that he has is that he is neither of those things. He is very willing to be very vocally anti-American. Now, when he has these interviews in English, he'll say, I'm not anti-West. I spent a good chunk of my life in my West. Of course, he doesn't say it, like sleeping around and womanizing and boozing in the West. But he says, I'm not anti-West. I'm not anti-American. I just don't want us to be your slave. So when he says this in English, he sounds much more, with what I'm looking for, even keeled. He's not trying to alienate the West, but he's trying to reset relations. However, when you listen to the things that he says to his rallies in Urdu, I don't terribly feel confident that he is saying both things in both languages with the same intention. He's been very conciliatory towards the Pakistan Taliban. He opposes military operations against them. He has had a very bizarre position on Pakistan's blasphemy law. He has not outright denounced it. What he has said is that he has big issues with some politicians making political gains out of it. Given that politicians suffer the penalty of death for raising it, it's hard for me to characterize anyone's position as being able to make political gains out of opposing or even suggesting the blasphemy be reformed. So I think he's someone that we should be watching for, because I think the army likes him. They no longer have a coup. All they have to do is prorogue the government, rig elections, and put him in some sort of weak coalition where he's the head of a king's party.
So just in the last few minutes then, Christopher, clearly the relationship between the U.S. and NATO and the Pakistani military, these are friends without benefits. And in effect, there's a protection.
Well, they're not even friends.
Right. Well, but we're operating along the basis of a kind of protection racket that's not working. And now they pull the plug on the supplies.
Actually, that's not true, Ian. This sort of reveals the venal kabuki theater that is Pakistani domestic politics. What they have done is they have said the G-locks will be closed. Now, in the past, they've closed them for up to 3 weeks. Why do they open it for 3 weeks? Because, as you said, the protection racket wants its money, right? Any dedicated insurgent would be sitting there at the border points blowing up trucks. Pilferage, to overall loss between 1% and 5%. Really what's happening is the Pashtun Mafia controls that. The National Logistics Cell, which is a part of the Pakistan military, everyone's making a lot of money off of this. So I don't really see it closing. But one thing that people haven't mentioned, which is probably good from my point of view, is that the only thing that's being discussed are the ground lines of control. We are flying so many flights over Pakistani airspace. Over the last year and change, we've decreased the amount of lethal goods and other things that are necessary for Afghanistan traveling on Pakistan's roads, and we've basically replaced that with air traffic. And then we are trying to bring things into the northern distribution route, but the Russians won't let us move things that are lethal, and obviously you need lethal products to wage a war. The other thing that they've been howling about, a very long-standing drama, is over the drones, right? We've been basing these drones out of Pakistan territory. Their forces protect our forces on those bases, and now they are quote, that we are requesting the Americans to vacate Shamsi. What is not mentioned, of course, is that we actually have drones at two bases. So this is basically the Pakistan military trying to wrench as many concessions out of the Americans while placating their public. They're not shutting down the logistics. They've been very selective in discussing how they do this.
So just in closing then, what is the likelihood of making a deal with the Russians? I mean, you go from one mafia payoff to another, wouldn't you?
Well, look, the idea, look, I don't follow U.S.-Russian relations very closely, so I'm not the right person to discuss this with. But as it pertains to Afghanistan, we have a couple of issues. one, the likelihood of a U.S.-Russian reset isn't very likely with Putin and his various Machiavellian maneuverings. And then the part of the problem with Russia and Afghanistan is that, of course, it has big issues with NATO. So this is Russia's position on the Northern Distribution Route is just as much to corner us and to put us into a problematic position as it is NATO. And obviously, the Russians aren't terribly thrilled about our presence in Afghanistan, right? They really don't want there to be any sort of contest of wills between the Americans and the Russians in the Central Asian states that abut Afghanistan.
But they don't want the Taliban to win, though, do they?
You know, look, they're kind of like Iran. They don't want the Taliban to win, but they certainly don't want to make make things easier for the Americans.
It's Schadenfreude, then.
It's totally Schadenfreude. They don't want the complete region to go to hell in a handbasket because they have to clean it up. But on the other hand, Russia has enough buffers, right? There's Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, all the Central Asian republics will sort of buffer it. And then, as you said, we've got Russian mafia interests, right? The Russian mafia are very much involved in the narco trafficking that comes out of Afghanistan. So it's not as simple as they don't want us to win or they don't want us to lose. It's just that multiple entities involve NATO countries, Russia, United States, non-state actors. They all have different equities, and everyone is trying to jointly optimize, given certain constraints that exist in the system.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within the Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Previously, she served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate in the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began, went to Cairo, Egypt, to get an update on the Egyptian elections, where the Salafists did extremely well with over 24%. Of the vote. That's the Muslim fundamentalists funded by the Saudis. The Muslim Brotherhood did 37%. Together, they obviously have a substantial majority. Our guest, Yasmin El-Rashidi, who wrote the e-book, The Battle for Egypt, she says that, in fact, the liberals and the military will probably have some kind of rapprochement because she doesn't think that anybody particularly wants Egypt to become an Iran or a Saudi Arabia. If that is indeed the wishes, it is the wishes of the Salafists for sure, and that the real battle is coming up now in the parliament about writing a new constitution. And then once that's done, there will be, of course, the presidential elections. And she thinks, again, it's likely not to be a Muslim fundamentalist, but a more secular person that will eventually be the president. Then Julie Levine joined us in the studio. She's been with Occupy LA movement from the beginning. She really went to town on the LAPD and the sheriffs, citing and any number of brutality and abuses. Chapter and verse, she walked us through what happened to all of these protesters when they're arrested and painted an extremely bleak picture of police brutality, out of sight, out of mind, in spite of the fact that everybody's celebrating how well the mayor of Los Angeles handled the event and the eviction of the tent city at City Hall. She said, out of sight, out of mind, in the police buses, etc. A whole different story took place. And then I was joined by Chris Fair, one of the leading experts on Pakistan. She speaks the language, knows the people, goes there a lot. She's somebody who really does know what she's talking about. She said that, in fact, the 24 Pakistani soldiers who were recently killed, they initiated fire first. NATO then asked for permission from the Pakistani military to retaliate, and they were given permission. So there's a whole lot more to that story than what we've heard so far. But clearly, the Pakistanis hold the cards and are essentially running a protection racket. And Uncle Sam, of course, once again, will have to be Uncle Sucker. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.